come on a journey with a cinephile.
Wake up, sucker. We're thieves and we're bad guys. That's exactly what we are.
Welcome, listeners, to episode 234 of Journey with a Cinephile, a horror movie podcast. As always, I'm your tour guide here of David Garrett Jr., recording out of Columbus, Ohio. So in this episode here for you is going to be my foray through the fours number four, as the two featured reviews are going to be The Ninth Guest and Abigail. Now, the through line here actually is that we have two movies that are set in isolated locations where characters are not allowed to leave. Both could be supernatural, and, you know, there could be logical explanations for both to not be. You'll have to decide. So then for mini reviews here, I have a documentary of More Brains, A Return to the Living Dead. I got to check out my foray through the fours rewatch of The Beast Must Die. Then I have a screener that I got to check out of Pandemonium, and then a short slasher film from India that I got to check out as well called Blood Play. And then the final episode of Fear the Walking Dead was going to be on this episode as well. So I don't really have anything else here for this intro that I need to go into. So what I will say is I hope you enjoy coming on this journey with me, as well as thank you for listening.
Journey with a Cinephile.
Then my first mini review for this week is going to be a documentary that I got to watch while I was working of More Brains, A Return to the Living Dead. This was directed by Bill Philpott, and then this was written amongst Tommy Hudson, Christian Sellers, and Gary Smart. I think Hudson actually wrote like a book version of this, and then this is kind of just borrowing elements from that. But this stars Jules Brenner, Don Kelfa, and James D'Alessandro, amongst a ton of other people. This is a documentary that is from the United States. It is currently sitting on a 7.7 on IMDb and a 3.6 on Letterboxd, with a synopsis being a retrospective documentary about making the horror cult classic The Return of the Living Dead. So this is a documentary that I learned about a few years ago, but hadn't gotten around to seeing it. I believe that my Blu-ray disc that I own, I have the special edition of this one, so I do actually have it. I confirmed it before recording, but I ended up streaming this on Screambox while I was working. Now, to give more background to what drew me to this, I love The Return of the Living Dead, the basis. Now, where I want to start is that this is a blast. It is amazing to see all these cast members and crew behind the camera that they could, like, compile together and to kind of share different stories, but we have the likes of, like, Clu Gulager, James Caron, Tom Matthews, Kelfka, Miguel A. Nunez Jr., Lene Quigley, Beverly Randolph, John Philbin, and Jewel Shepherd for the actors. Now, we also have Brenner, D'Alessandro, Graham Henderson, and others who manage the production. What I'll say here is that I'm glad that they interviewed the older members for sure. This record is something that is great to have for a cult classic like this, since we have so many of these people starting to pass away. Now that I've said that, it's interesting to hear different stories of the production and hearing their sides of it. It gives an intriguing perspective to these young actors and their interactions with Dan O'Bannon, who directed this and co-wrote the film. Hearing how he butted heads with someone who was proven like Gulager was interesting. Despite the rigorous shooting schedule and the budget that they had to work with, they created magic. That unique perspective helps me to appreciate this movie even more. I'll say this documentary is well made. I like that it progresses through like pre-production, what went into getting the setup and the casting. They go through the process through the movie, like how they would rehearse and then going into stories and what made the shoot difficult. It then goes into briefly about how well this did in its legacy. I do like that they had like setup effects with almost like a comic book feel as it fades out of their topics to the next. It feels a bit cheesy, but that fits the vibe of this film for sure. Incorporating it in the soundtrack made me smile as well. I'd highly recommend this if you're a fan of the movie. This is a fun perspective and insights that you can get. I'd also say that if you like documentaries about how movies are made, this one doesn't go too deep into it. They do discuss challenges and workarounds that they did, so this is more about hearing the stories of those that made this film possible, and I loved that. So my rating here is going to be the highest that I can give to a documentary at an 8 out of 10. Then up next is my Foray Through the Forest rewatch of The Beast Must Die. This is from 1974, directed by Paul Annette. This was written by Michael Winder, and then we also have a couple other people that are helping out here. And that would be, the novel was written by James Blish, and then Annette and Scott Finch did some uncredited work as well. This stars Kelvin Lockhart, Peter Cushing, and Marlene Clark. This is a horror mystery film from the United Kingdom, currently sitting on a 5.6 on IMDb and a 2.8 on Letterboxd with Snopsbian. 8 people are invited to an island estate for the weekend. One of them is a werewolf. Can you guess which one? So this is one that I found due to it being in the horror movie encyclopedia that I'm working through. I watched it years ago and thought it was solid. Something that struck me was that this was a murder mystery where the werewolf, or at least what they think is a werewolf, doing the killing. I remember that the main character was trying to figure out who it was before it was too late. This feels a lot like Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None. I also remember that it featured one of my favorite actors in Cushing. There's also Charles Gray, Anton Differing, Clark, and a young Michael Gambon. So where I want to start then is that this is an Amicus production. They tried to do something a bit different here. Now, the Gialli film would already be popular in Italy. Plus, murder mysteries were all the rage since the beginning of cinema. Like, you always seem to have them, even back in like the 20s and 30s. United Kingdom would know how to do them well by this point. Now, the detective film would also be something that's been done for decades. Werewolf films would have been out, of course, but not as often. I like the combination here since it's something that is a bit different. So let's delve back into what we're getting here. First, let's start with our character of Tom, who is the main guy, Tom Newcliffe, portrayed by Lockhart. It's interesting that he's black. He's rich, and that fortune was self-made. He has important friends, as we see. There's an intriguing dynamic here for the fact that, from the beginning, Tom seems like he's insane. He's convinced that one of his friends are a werewolf. There are facts that he uses. It seems like vicious attacks follow these different people from cities they go to. Whether it's a coincidence or they are the ones conducting the attacks, there just isn't the evidence there. Tom hopes to prove that he's right. Now, he's also a hunter, so he wants to bag this creature since no one in the world has. I like that the more we learn and as the events unfold, he might not be as crazy as he comes off. Lockhart works so well in this role as he drives it for sure. Then going from there, I like how the rest of the group comes off as red herrings. I'll go ahead and discuss the acting since that's what helps bring these characters to life. So we have Bennington, who's portrayed by Gray, and he thinks that these tests are childish. He only partakes to help alleviate tension. Then we also have Sierra Madden, who is portraying Davina. Now, she comes off scared of Tom for good reason. That also makes her seem guilty to me. Plus, she can't always be accounted for when her, I don't know if it's her husband or her significant other of Jan, portrayed by Gambon. Now, he's a concert pianist, so there are cities where his performances are happening that these attacks are also coinciding. Now, it does seem like he might have an alibi because he is supposed to be performing, so I'm not really sure if that's what they're going for, but Gambon works in that role as well. Wild to see him as young as he is here. One of the better performances, I would have to say, would be Tom Chadbon, who plays Paul Foote. He just is pushing the buttons of Tom on purpose. It isn't smart, but enjoyable for what we're getting. Cushing is great as well. He's an expert on these monsters, so that could allow him to hide in plain sight. He's never actually seen one in person, though. He's just going off of, like, legend and what he has. Clark is good as a more subdued role. Now, I saw her in this before Ganja and Hess, so I like seeing her range, and it's kind of crazy going back and watching that movie. I think then I'll go to the rest of the cast. Differing was good as this guy who's helping run the security system. There's a confidence that gets him into trouble later. I also thought that Andrew Lodge is solid as this helicopter pilot. Now, he takes Tom around and helps him do, like, hunting and stuff. So the cast was solid across the board, including those I've already brought up. All that's left in his filmmaking, I thought this was well made. I love the isolated location. It makes it hard to get away. It doesn't help as we see that Tom will hunt these down, you know, to kind of try things there. That adds tension. The cinematography and framing were good to capture this place, so credit there. If I have any gripes, it would be with the effects. I don't love that they're using, like, a big black dog as the werewolf. That confused me a bit. I did like what they're going with a more feral version, though. We do get a de-transformation scene, so that worked. Other than that, I thought the soundtrack fit for what was needed. The design of the wolf calls were good. Should also say here that we get this weird, like, 30-second timer where you try to guess who the werewolf is after all this information has been presented. I thought that was kind of, it's very niche. It is a gimmick, but it is what it is. That's something Amicus would do a lot of. In conclusion, I'm glad that I gave this a rewatch. What I will say is I didn't remember who the werewolf was, so it felt like a first-time watch for that. I didn't guess who the monster was either time. We have a solid cast, being led by Lockhart, Cushing, Clark, Gray, Differing, Chadbot, and Gambon also working in support of him. I love the setting and how this is captured with the cinematography. My only gripe is that the werewolf not looking more menacing. There is an interesting concept, though. I'd recommend this on that alone. Being that this is from Amicus, which is another perk for me, so if you're a fan, check this out. So my rating here for The Beast Must Die is going to be a 7 out of 10 with the second time around. And the last feature that I'm going to be covering here for mini reviews is going to be Pandemonium. This is from 2023, but getting its wide release here this year. This is directed and written by Quarks, I think is how you'd say that. This is starring Arben Bajrak-Tarja, Hugo Dillon, and Ophelia Klob. This is a horror film that's from France. It is currently sitting on a 4.6 on IMDb and a 2.9 on Letterboxd with our synopsis. After realizing that he has died at the scene of a car crash, Nathan descends into the depths of hell where he is doomed to experience the pain of tortured souls along the way. So I should say here, Nathan is being portrayed by Dylan, and this is a movie that I got the chance to see thanks to Justin Cook when he sent over a screener link. Now, when I saw this was a horror film that hit festivals in 2023 and getting a wide release in 2024, I was in. Being that this is foreign also adds to it, since I like to get an array of countries to truly decide how good a year is overall for its releases. So, where I'm going to end up starting is that this doesn't have the deepest story, but also doesn't need it. We're getting the classic idea that is brought forth by Christianity that there are two places you go when you die. Something interesting here is that we're seeing the concept of Nathan not accepting his fate. He was in the same accident that killed not only himself, but Daniel, who is portrayed by Bajrak-Tarja. Now, but the latter died on impact. He has been in the afterlife longer. I love that this is exploring the idea that a second in the real world could be minutes on the other side, or even more. That gets explored as we follow Nathan's journey, and I like the idea that of a decision that Nathan has made led him to the punishment that he is going to be going through. So then, let's delve a bit deeper into this character. I'm not going to fully reveal what the lead did to lead him to hell, but let's just say that it's someone close to him was suffering and he decided to put them out of their misery. We look at it as humanity would, as it could be seen as a mercy killing. What causes stress here is that the demons don't see it that way. They look at a gray situation as black and white. That's terrifying. He is being punished for doing what he thought was right. Now, I'm glad that this doesn't get revealed later until... like, we know what he did, but the particulars get revealed much later. He just tells Daniel in the opening scene that he killed somebody. There's also an interesting idea here as things kind of go along that technically he killed Daniel as well, even if it was an accident. Now, we see how strict things are with this little girl who joins the afterlife. I did want to credit Dylan here as this character that we follow. Now, where I want to go from there is the concept of hell. It is taking aspects of Dante Alighieri's 14th century epic poem of the Divine Comedy. There are different rings of hell, and what you do decides which one you go to. There's a guide of Nurgle, who is a demon. Nathan tries to plead with him, and he points out that he's not the one to judge. He just kind of carries out the punishments. I did love that aspect. We also get to see Billy, who is this freakish person who also, or like almost like a freakish demon, I guess you should probably say here, doing what he's told. This goes dark where the story ends up. I love using Christian mythology to tell the story. Now, part of Nathan's punishment is that he experiences a couple of people he touches in hell. First, let me say here that I love that Quarks, who wrote and directed this, decided to make hell look like it's from the beyond or the void. I'm a fan there. He touches a little girl who is named Janine. She is terrifying as we see her story play out with what happens there. And then she has interactions with a deformed person named Tony, who is portrayed by Carl Laforte. And I like how that might not actually be... there might be some things here that aren't as necessarily what we see. Now, there's another story here of Julia, portrayed by Klob, coming to terms with what happened to her daughter of Chloe, who's portrayed by Sidwell Weber. These tug to my heartstrings for a couple different reasons, so credit to the filmmaking there. I like that a child can be evil, and then, of course, there is a cardinal sin as well. That is where I'll leave it, but I'll just credit these actors for bringing these stories to life. It almost made me think that this was going to be an anthology. It's just using elements. All that's left then would be the rest of the filmmaking. I'll credit the cinematography here. The afterlife looks like ours. We see that Daniel and Nathan can affect our world with something that happens. I like what we get with the cinematography and framing to bring this to life. The look of hell is good. That's terrifying for sure. We don't get a lot in the way of effects. We don't need them. There are a couple scenes that needed more blood, but that's not an issue, though, either. What is good, though, is the look of Tony and the demons that we meet in hell. I also like Chloe. Her eyes were creepy. Other than that, I thought the sound design and music fit for what was needed. So in conclusion, I'm glad that I checked this movie out. We're playing with classic source material here by incorporating elements of the Divine Comedy. Also, the use of Christian mythology is good as well. I thought that this was a, you know, simple story, but the backstories and how things fit together carries this. The acting was good in bringing the characters to life. That also helps to present the story. I'd say that this is well made. The cinematography, setting, and effects were good as well. I'd warn you that this is from France, so I watch it with subtitles on. If that's not an issue and you like what I've said here, give this one a watch. So my rating here for Pandemonium is going to be an 8 out of 10. And from the press release I was looking at, this is going to be hitting the Arrow player. And I'm assuming it'll also be on hard copy through them as well. And I do have a mini review here for a short that I got the chance to watch called Blood Play. This is from 2018. It was written, directed, and stars Abhishek Das. And then we also have Deepak Da and Aditya Da. There's no IMDb or Letterboxd pages, but this is a slasher film of sorts from India. And the synopsis is: a murderous week of a mental patient suffering from suicidal tendencies and goes missing without a trace. So this is one I got the chance to check out thanks to Pupo Das, who reached out to me via Facebook to see if I would check this out, this short film. I'm assuming he's related to the writer, director, and star. I was hooked on that this was horror, but he also said that it was a slasher film. Not a place where you get movies like this normally, so that intrigued me to check this out. So what I will say is that much like other slashers, we don't have the deepest story. We have Abhishek. If I mispronounce your name, I do apologize. But playing our suicidal character, we see that he's on the roof of a building, having slit his wrist with a straight razor. A friend comes looking for him and panics when he sees what he's done. He drags him inside and calls for help. The problem is that Abhishek is just getting started. Now, where I want to go is with positives. I thought that this does good things by ramping up the violence and the practical effects used. This borders on going into exploitation. Now, I'm not a gore hound per se, but this leans into doing what they know they can. The only drawback is that from the beginning, there should be like a, something that happens there with more blood, with a wound. I'm not going to hold that against this short film, though. My guess is that they don't have the biggest budget working with what they can, so I'll credit there. As someone who focuses on the story when watching things, I do wish this fleshed out more. The title on YouTube also has this line of, it's not inside your head, but inside your blood. I think that's something they needed to explore more. There is a reoccurring motif here where Abhishek is using a syringe to take blood from his victims. He also sticks his finger in a wound as well. I do think this would add a layer if we figured out why. The excuse that he's insane isn't enough for me. I just need more to work with. Another aspect is that we have characters doing things and nothing comes of it. There is this opening person who is attacked that calls for help. We see that no one shows up. Then we have two characters who are in the area to collect taxes. They see that something is wrong with Abhishek. The one who goes to help him and then disappears, there are others who call their friends to help and days go by, but we don't see if they come or not. It just feels like plot device is a progressive story and nothing comes of it. Again, I just need more to work with there. There's also this thing that happens at the very end that I thought it was kind of interesting and kind of cool. I wish they would have went more with that as well, as it almost is setting the stage to kind of flesh things out to more, or maybe have like another one to follow this. But I don't like that it just kind of introduces this and then that's it. I'll then go to the acting. I do think that what we get here is fine. Since the characters aren't fleshed out, we don't know much about them. So we're really just kind of, that, I mean, it sticks with like low-budget slashers in general that I've seen. If we aren't going to develop more of a story, then we need the characters to have backstories to help. That is one thing that I look for to make slashers work. I do think that this is lacking, and I'm not going to harp on the performances, as they're fine for what they needed to while being attacked. All that's left on is filmmaking. I've already said that the effects were good, just some slight nitpicks here and there. I'd say that I thought the setting of this was dark and creepy with that apartment was good. The cinematography helps to capture that. We are limited to the angles and movements, but that's fine. This borders more on something that's like exploitative and violent. There's some grittiness that comes with that. Thought the sound design worked for the screams. I don't remember much of the soundtrack, but it didn't take me out of this ill either. So in conclusion, I'd say this is a decent low-budget slasher short. I like that it is that length. There are elements here that could be fleshed out into something longer if they like. We just need that. The bright spots here for the effect, cinematography, and setting. There are some nitpicks that I have there, and I thought that the characters showed fear and terror with what is happening. Abhishek is good as this crazed individual. I'd only recommend this to fans of more like exploitation cinema and gorehounds, because I think there are things here you could enjoy. So my rating, though, for Blood Play is going to be a 4.5 out of 10. And the people that, you know, reach out to me and everything like that, don't take that as necessarily as a negative. I just think that there are some things here that if you flesh it out, it'll definitely jump over that 5, which is kind of my neutral score. And I'm also going to have the link if you want to check this one out in the show notes. And then my review when it comes out will also have that there as well. And I'm going to cover the last episode of Fear the Walking Dead. This one went by the title of The Road Ahead. This is directed by Michael E. Stratzemis. And the synopsis is, as the series comes to an end, the fate of Padre's survivors seem to rest in the hands of an unexpected hero. So for this one here, what I'm going to go ahead and just say is that we start off with Tracy hiding. And, of course, she is being portrayed by Antoinella Rose. And now we see that Madison has flashes back to, like, her kids and everything. So, you know, definitely, like, last episode type thing. Madison Clark, of course, is being portrayed by Dickens. And now we see that there's some hiding in trees and whatnot. That would be Tracy as she's trying to get away. And then we also get to see that in the area here we have Dwight, who is portrayed by Austin Amilo. And we also have Sherry, Christine Evangelista, and then there's, of course, Luciana, portrayed by Danae Garcia. And then we also have Daniel being portrayed by Ruben Blades. So then we have that there might be something here where Alicia might have been pregnant, and that Troy might have stole this kid. Troy be, of course, Daniel Sharman. And that he supposedly killed Alicia. But then we see that there's a ship full of the undead that is coming for Padre. So decisions have to be made here. So this is Troy's crew. And then they were supposed to be they're being led by somebody who's not his second-in-command. Because his second-in-command is actually Russell, portrayed by Randy Bernalas. But he is in, they have him as a prisoner over on Padre. And then we see that they're letting these zombies out. They are going into the water. It's almost like D-Day. I thought that was kind of cool. And then they're like, the walls seem to be holding up, so they're not really worried. But then there seems to be something going on where they're being damaged. And it turns out that Troy's crew had some grenade launchers they've been holding on to. This gets revealed that Alicia might actually still be alive. And there's like also they could be using some people here as a decoy. And then like she died. She might not have. We get to see that Daniel is ruthless with his anger. And then Tracy actually gets away by shooting Madison, so that kind of has a thing there. Now, she ends up going out and finding the Troy zombie and kills him. She's, you know, pretty distraught. And then we end up getting a cut over here that Padre might be destroyed. And then we actually get to what really happened here. I feel like there's a little bit of a cheat or whatever right there. Strand, actually, you know, Coleman Domingo is talking to Tracy. She's upset and flees. And then we actually get some stuff here that Troy might have lied about, you know, some of the things, everything like that. And it's kind of interesting is that Padre gets a name change. And then we actually have a lot of people deciding what they're going to do as this ends out and where they're going to go. People are making amends and everything. I gave this last episode here a 7 out of 10. A little bit cheesy. Doesn't necessarily do a whole lot to finally stand out. I think it is a good send-off, I will say that. And I would say Fear the Walking Dead overall is going to be an 8 out of 10 for me as well. So that's all I have here for mini review. So let me go ahead and get you over to the trailer of my first featured review.
I'll repeat. A paid telegram to Dr. Murray Reed, 219 Temple Avenue, City. Congratulations, a stop. Plans afoot for small party in your honor. Manville penthouse next Saturday, 10 p.m., a stop. Maintain secrecy, a stop. Promise you most original party ever slated. Signed, your host.
Congratulations.
Good news, Mr. Abbott?
Oh, no. Invitation to a party.
Gentlemen, you are promised the most original party ever given in this city. Tonight, my friends, we are to play an amusing game in which each of you will have ample opportunity to to use your brain, or tonight you are commanded to play an absorbing game, a game of death. There is no escape. The gates by which you entered the garden are also charged with electricity. Stop. Don't drink. You are about to meet my guest of honor, the ninth guest.
The ninth guest?
His name is Death.
And for my first feature review here is going to be The Ninth Guest. This is from 1934. It is directed by Roy William Neal. And then the screen adaptation is done by Garnett Weston. Now, this was from the play by Owen Davis. And then it looks like based on the book by Gwen Bristow and Bruce Manning. This is starring Donald Cook, Genevieve Tobin, and Hardy Albright, while also featuring Edward Ellis, Edwin Maxwell, Vince Barnett, Helen Flint, Samuel S. Hines, Nella Walker, Sidney Bracey, Mildred Gover, Arthur Hoyt, Mary McLaurin, Billy Seward, Gain Whitman, and Charles C. Wilson. This is a drama horror mystery film that is from the United States. It is currently sitting on a 6.7 on IMDb and a 3.3 on Letterboxd, with our synopsis being: eight people are invited to dinner in a fashionable penthouse apartment. After they are wined and dined, a voice in the radio informs them that they'll be murdered unless they manage to outwit the ninth guest, Death. So this is a movie that I didn't know existed until searching for horror films from 1934 for my foray through the fours. What was interesting here is that I just watched another movie from our director, Black Moon, which was featured last episode. I've seen a couple of his later works with Universal. Now, the title here made me think what we'd be getting here. I just didn't necessarily know if it was, I wasn't sure exactly what it would be, but I, you know, came in knowing what the title was. I had to find the correct one on YouTube and make sure, like, the running time and then, like, the people matched up and everything like that. So that is what I did there. So let me go ahead and do some featured notes here, and I'll start with our director, Neil Hem, 76 features and two shorts. I've seen four of his works. They are the four he's done in genre with this: Black Moon, Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, and The Black Room. Now, there's an assistant director here of Arthur S. Black Jr. He helped on 29 projects. His most popular I've seen was It's a Wonderful Life. This is the only one he did in horror. Now, we have a handful of writers here. First is Weston, who wrote 21 films. I've seen three, all horror with this: White Zombie and Supernatural. Then over to Davis. He wrote 12 movies in one short. First I've seen, his only one in genre. Now, he's one of the original writers and has 18 works adapted, has three in genre. I've only ever seen this. His others are Lola from 1914 and The Haunted House from 1928. There's also Manning, who wrote two projects, only one that I've seen, and in horror. Then the same with Bristow. Two films, only one in genre. So let's move over to the cast. First I'll start with our star here of Cook. He was in 57 features and three shorts. I've seen him in two things, both in genre. Has four total. He was in this and Mad Genius that I've now seen. He was in The Munsters, Scary Little Christmas, and Murder in the Blue Room from 44 as well. Those are the two I haven't seen yet, even though I have seen the original German version of the latter film. Then I'll take a look at Tobin. She has 37 movies and three shorts. First thing that I've seen her in, her only one in horror. Last is Albright. He was in 48 projects, and I've seen three. He was uncredited as the voice of adolescent Bambi for Disney. He did three in genre with this, The Mad Doctor of Market Street that I've seen. He was also in The Jade Mask from 1945, which is one that I haven't as of yet. So for this one, we start off in the telegraph office. We're seeing different operators taking down messages and addresses. There actually some of this played for comedy with things that are trying to be sent and like the things that they're saying back to them. But we end up focusing on the last one, and she tells the caller that she'll send his message to the eight places provided. We then meet these characters. First is Jason Osgood, portrayed by Maxwell. He's rich, and he's backing Burke, who's portrayed by Wilson, for the mayor race. We also see that along with Dr. Murray Reed, who is portrayed by Hines, that they have a Henry Abbott, portrayed by Albright, was fired from his position at a university. Abbott has radical beliefs, and the time this is set, it wasn't so difficult to do. And, like, I'm not shocked that he would lose his job over it. There are shady things in the past of Burke that hurt his reputation. With that groundwork set, we see that people are invited to a dinner party from the synopsis. Dr. Reed and Osgood are two. The latter also learns that Tim Cronin's lawyer found the information about Burke. Cronin is being portrayed by Ellis. Now, Cronin also gets an invite to this party, so that creates tension. A Margaret Chisholm, portrayed by Walker, gets invited. She has her finger on the pulse of social circles around town. Now, she also knows Cronin's daughter, but doesn't want to help her when she is asked. Round out the invites, we have Jean Trent, portrayed by Tobin, who is an actor. There's also James Daly, portrayed by Cook, who is a playwright. Now, something here is that these two know each other, and they have feelings there. It's actually kind of interesting because I believe they share, like, property because their parents thought they were going to get married, so they wanted to make sure that, like, this was all, like, the paperwork was set up. But these two have kind of went separate ways. They still kind of walk around in the same circles, though. Now, Abbott is also invited, creating more tension. And the eighth is Sylvia Inglesby, who is portrayed by Flint. Now, she is there with Cronin. So people start to show up to the location of the dinner party. Osgood and Chisholm are the first. They are trying to figure out who this house belongs to, or like who's renting it or anything like that. When Cronin arrives with Sylvia, the first couple are ready to leave. They change their mind, though, as others arrive. So then we have Hawkins, who is a butler portrayed by Bracey, who was hired to run things, and he's going smoothly at first. There is levity here added by William Jones, portrayed by Barnett, who's a bumbling assistant. The latter tries to serve drinks and spills them in the process. This night was meticulously planned, and we're seeing that things are getting derailed already. It then takes a dark turn when Hawkins turns on the radio. A voice seems to be talking to their guests. They learn they cannot escape. The elevator doors are now electrified. The other exits of this building are the same. There is a vial of rustic acid, I think that's what it was called, on the mantle. If anyone decides this is too much, they can end their lives. They need to figure out who is behind this and why. The voice on the radio seems to be watching them and knows their every move. That is where I'll leave my recap production of the characters. Where I want to start is that this movie was ahead of its time, and it's ahead of the curve as well. It is based off a play that started as a novel called The Invisible Host. What is wild is that in my notes, I put down this felt like Agatha Christie's and Then There Were None. This novel predates that one by almost a decade. Another thing is that this reminded me of The Laplace's Demon. That came out in 2017, but the newer movie has a similar setup with some different things they do in execution. Now that I've set that up and provided background information, let me delve into the story first. I like the premise here. It is simple in that we gather a group of characters, they're connected, and there is history. This gives motive for any of the characters to be the killer. Cronin has rubbed the most people the wrong way, and he's hated. Osgood is rich, so that makes people harbor issues there. Abbott was fired from the university, so he has an axe to grind. Jim and Jean's parents wanted to get married, so there's property that is held in a trust. They both must agree on what to do with it. That is unless one of them dies. I'm a fan of murder mysteries where this kept me guessing. And to play off of that, I love the fact that this radio is talking to our characters. This feels ahead of its time, though, since I don't know if there could be like cameras in the room for that person to not be there directly. The technology hampers this for me. There's also a supernatural feel that the person talking to the radio might know things they shouldn't be able to. The reveal here does well to pull back in, though, and it worked for me, and it actually kind of explains some of these issues I've already laid out here. It fits in line with the logical explanation for the era that was made. What makes this work, though, is the cast, and I'll be honest, I don't think this does well enough in setting up the characters to where I knew exactly who each one was. The print wasn't in the greatest shape, and certain people look similar. I had to guess at times and wait until the name was said. I did like Cook and Tobin. They work well off each other. This duo comes off as the leads as things develop. Albright is good as this disgruntled character who is trapped with people that he's upset with and has done things to kind of put himself in that situation. Ellis worked well with this more villainous Cronin. Maxwell is a mirror of him. It is fitting that they don't get along. I thought Flint, Hines, and Walker helped to round out the rest of the guests. I like Bracey and how Barnett annoys him, the latter being there for comic relief. All that's left then is filmmaking before some trivia. I love that the setting was good. We have this modern penthouse apartment where these events take place. I loved the look of it. It also makes sense that the technology is more advanced as well. Trapping our characters is good. Seeing them trying to find an explanation and a way out works. I do think that this lost steam as it goes on, though. It meanders a bit despite the 67-minute runtime. The effects were limited, but what we got worked. I also like what they do with the sound design with the radio and how it plays into the reveal. This was well made for the year, I will say that. So then, some of the trivia here. The source material, The Invisible Host, was a novel by the husband and wife team of Gwen Bristow and Bruce Manning. Their whodunit was inspired by a neighbor whose loud radio disturbed them night and day. And the novel begins that this makes 37 words, said the girl. You read the telegram again, came over the voice of the wire. And so it's kind of interesting, is that took place in New Orleans, I believe. And then the stage version was written by Owen Davis. And this had a Broadway production that went 72 performances, so that's kind of cool there. At first glass, film aficionados assume that this borrowed from the Agatha Christie novel. It didn't, because this was first. The centerpiece of the Art Deco penthouse is a grandfather clock concealed behind a curved wall, except for the face of the clock and the bottommost tip of the pendulum, which swings ominously, a smiley face window of light. Thought that was kind of cool. It looks like by no means a lost film, but unfortunately locked up at present time with legal complications. I wonder what's happening there. While the poster gives the title of The Ninth Guest, the opening credits have it spelled out, not just with like the number 9. And then this kind of gives some trivia here about the where this is going to be taking place and each of the people where their telegram is being sent. And the castles is incomplete, as there are several roles in the film that are not credited, like the cook, Chisholm's guests, and butler and everything like that. And now there's actually a very long one that falls into spoilers, so I'm not going to do that one. But I will say, in conclusion, I'm glad that I could take this off my list. It's interesting that this predates and then there were none by almost a decade, as they have similar premises. We have a solid cast of characters. My only issue is that I think we need just a bit more to differentiate them better, as the actual dinner scene would help. Their performances were solid. I say that this was made well enough with the setting, trapping the characters, and how information was presented through sound design. Just wanted a bit more on my end to fully work. I'd recommend this if you're interested in early horror movie cinema or a movie that predated Christie-style mysteries. So my rating here for The Ninth Guest is going to be a 7 out of 10. Not going to do a spoiler section. That would just be me kind of revealing things there. And even though this movie is 90-plus years old, I'm not going to do that. So let me go ahead and get you over to the trailer of my second featured review.
Please let me out. I'm scared.
Cut the shit.
You're really good at pretending to be a little girl.
Thank you.
Quick question. Who's inside a cage right now?
What do we know about vampires? How do we kill it?
Crucifixes.
Stake through the heart.
Daylight is a big one.
We need to find a way out of here.
We split up.
This is just a game to her.
What can I say? I like playing with Liza.
Hello?
And for my second featured review is going to be Abigail. This is from here in 2024. It is written, or it's directed between Matt Bentinelli-Olpin and Tyler Gillette. These are Radio Silence, if you didn't know. I always forget that until I settle down and see the credits. But then Stephen Shields came up with the story, as well as co-wrote this with Guy Busick. This stars Melissa Barra, Dan Stevens, and Alicia Ware, while also featuring William Catlett, Catherine Newton, Kevin Durand, Angus Cloud in his final film, R.I.P., Giancarlo Esposito, and Matthew Good. This is a horror thriller film that is a co-production between Ireland, United States, and Canada, currently sitting on a 7.1 on IMDb and a 3.3 on Letterboxd with a synopsis beam. After a group of criminals kidnap the ballet dancer daughter of a powerful underworld figure, they retreat to an isolated mansion, unaware that they're locked inside with no normal little girl. So this one that I saw was coming to the Gateway Film Center, and I was intrigued because everything I was looking at it looked good. I'm going to be kind of guarded here about spoilers, so keep that in mind, but it had a solid cast with Barra, Stevens, Newton, Durand, and Esposito. I also like that our directing team was from, you know, Ready or Not and Scream from 2022. I actually forgot they did Scream 6 as well. I saw too much of the trailer, which gives the reveal. It was also all over the IMDb page. So this probably would have been more fun if it wasn't spoiled for me, but I do digress. So let's do some featured notes here, and I'll first start with our directing duo, and they're actually the same type of stuff here. Bentinelli-Olpin and Gillette have 8 features, and Bentinelli-Olpin has 4 shorts, where Gillette only has 2, but they all have the same 8 features together. I've seen 6 of their works, all in horror for 75% total. So they did Ready or Not, as I said. They did a short in VHS and Southbound. I haven't yet seen Devil's Due or the upcoming Reunion film, because, of course, I've also seen Scream and Scream 6. Then to our writers, Shields came up with a story and co-wrote this. He has three features. I've seen this and Hole in the Ground. Everything that he's done that is out, I've seen. He has a third one that is upcoming that doesn't have a release date yet of Box of Bones. And this is the first credit he's got with coming up with the story. Then to Busick, our other writer. He's worked with his directing duo on the Scream movies, Ready or Not, as well as this. He has eight total. I've seen three. He has two upcoming in genre with Final Destination Bloodlines in 2025, which I did not know that was coming. And he's also going to be working on Reunion with our directors. Then to our cast. First is Ware. She has five movies. I've only ever seen this. Only one she's done in genre. Then to Bara. I've seen three of her 16 films. Also, she has one short. All those that are in genre would be I've seen. And then she has the two Scream films and now this. She's also in Bed Rest, which is on my list. And then she has Your Monster that looks like it's coming out this year. Then to Stevens. He came up, I believe, with Godzilla X Kong. I've seen seven of his 40 features. He has four shorts as well. Has seven in genre. I've seen this in Dracula from 2006. He has Cuckoo, which is coming out later this year. Didn't know he was in that. Now, he was also in Apostle and The Rental, which are also on my list to check out. His other two are Vamps and a take on The Turn of the Screw from 2009. So I'm going to do a few bonuses here as well. I brought up Newton when she was in Lisa Frankenstein. I've seen six of her 21 films. I've seen all but one that she's done in horror with That, This, and Paranormal Activity 4. I've not yet seen Freaky still. Also, briefly, is Durand. He has been in 44 films. I've seen 15 for 34%, four of his six horror films for 66%, and then Esposito has six films that I've seen of his 125 for 4%. I've seen two of his five horror films for 40% as well. So then for this one, we start off with some good filmmaking. We have this team of criminals that are getting into place. Joey is portrayed by Bara, as she is picked up by Peter, portrayed by Durand, and Frank, portrayed by Stevens. Another team is at the destination, which is Rickles, portrayed by Catlett, who has a sniper rifle. Now he's watching this house. The getaway driver is Dean, portrayed by Cloud, and Sammy, portrayed by Newton, bringing down the security system. Now the target is Abigail, who's portrayed by Weir, and we see her practicing her ballet. They are waiting for her to come home. And I should say that this is actually something that's in the movie, but all of their names at first kind of had to do with the Rat Pack, and then it's actually kind of funny is Rickles makes a joke, so he gets called for that actor there of Don Rickles. So then their plan goes on without issue. They take this girl to this remote mansion that is creepy. She's taken up to a room with a blindfold and handcuffed. At the place, they're met by Lambert, portrayed by Esposito, who wants them to stay on guard. They need to hold her for ransom for 24 hours. There is food and drink stocked for them. Now, the only one who is supposed to be going in and out of her room to talk to her is Joey. Now, she calms the girl and even makes it more comfortable for her. She removes the blindfold and handcuffs her in the front. Joey does wear a mask, though. This group isn't supposed to share personal information, but while they're having drinks and playing games, Dean tries to guess what everyone's background is. Joey points out that he's wrong, and then she guesses everyone right. Frank, though, reveals that she has a dark secret about her. Abigail then reveals something about her father being powerful to Joey. She doesn't want to know, but she tells Frank about her concern. She goes into her room for information. Now, he does this, that is, not realizing that she isn't blindfolded anymore. This causes him a start of fear, and then he gets more worried about everything because she can identify him now. She reveals to him who her father is. He's ready to leave and give up his cut of the money. This isn't as easy as he thinks, as Abigail has an even darker secret of her own. So that's really my recap introduction of the characters. What I want to start with this movie is that I saw people giving it praise. And this would be, like, voices in the community that I respect. It has interesting things as well where this is from professionals and other podcasters. That made me excited to give this a watch. What I will say is that this is a popcorn movie. We have a good premise where we strand a group with something that is faster, stronger, and more deadly than them. We then show them fighting for their lives. Something then to bring up here is that a buddy in a group chat said this feels like Ready or Not, which seeing that the directors are behind this, that makes sense. We have a large mansion where characters are looking around for whatever is killing them. There are also professional criminals. Rickles is a former Marine, not necessarily a criminal there, but he's turned to crime using his skill set. Peter is muscle. Frank was a former detective. It turns out that Joey was in the army as well. Sammy is good with computers, which doesn't necessarily play in here, but that's how she was in the group. Dean is the only non-professional, but he was a great wheelman from what we see. I'm a fan of playing with the idea of going up against something that is too much for people that are better equipped. I'll say that I also love this isolated setting and trapping the characters inside. That reminded me of Demons and its sequel. The next thing is something that I'm going to go a bit vague here, is I don't want to spoil what Abigail is. I'm guessing that everybody reading this or listening to me will know that she is a creature of sorts. She is a creature 100%. I do like how they manage the lore here. Joey knows what she is first. Sammy saw what this could do to somebody and doesn't believe it. Or it's kind of hard to believe it, I guess. Rickles and Frank know that something is wrong and it doesn't make sense. Peter refuses to believe it. I love that everyone tosses out what they know and they use these elements. I'm a fan when something with established lore is used and then a movie gives what their rules are and then they stick to them. I also love the look that they went with as well. I think that I'll shift to the acting. I'll say again that we have a good cast here. Bara is fine as our lead. She doesn't necessarily stand out to me though. Not bad by any stretch, but I still am just not the biggest fan of her, and if she ever hears this, I do apologize. I don't necessarily know if it's just the characters that she is taking on or what. Stevens is good as a detective turned criminal. I love that his backstory is muddled. Catlett is good as his former Marine. I like Newton as a rich girl who has decided to do crime for thrill. Durand is funny as his big dumb muscle. Cloud adds levity while being a street criminal who is good at what he does. I like Weir in her role. The use of ballet dancing adds an interesting element. That is something that is beautiful and graceful while combining it with how brutal this goes. I like that dichotomy. Other than that, I like the cameo by Esposito and Good as well. All that's left then before some trivia is filmmaking. I thought that the cinematography was good to capture this location and bring it to life. The isolated location and not being able to get out raises tension. Then having something hunt our characters builds even more. Thought that the attacks were framed well. This is a combination of CGI and practical effects from what I could tell. I don't love the former, but this had a budget, so it doesn't look bad though either. What is intriguing is the effect from Ready or Not was brought over with exploding bodies. That ramps up the gore. Other than that, I love the classical music used, especially when Abigail is dancing. That makes it even more eerie with what happens there, so no issues for this, how this was made. Cloud, this was his final role before passing in July of 2023. Production hadn't been completed, but it sounds like all of his scenes were already filmed. It sounds like the directors felt they needed to apologize to the cast for the volume of blood that was used. All of their movies are bloody, but this is definitely the most bloody with what they're doing there. Bara estimated that Weir did about 95% of her own stunts. It sounds like there was only one thing that might have used a little bit of CGI, but everything that she did, for the most part, was done practically, which is quite amazing because she does some really cool kind of dancing things, and a lot of her natural abilities were used there. Newton confirmed that this indeed got quite messy and that this is probably the scariest movie she's done so far. Calling the frightened kidnapped child of the character Abby and the alpha predator Abigail helped Weir approach the character as two different separate people, which I thought that was cool. Sounds like the trailer and the main theme from this one was actually using elements of Tchaikovsky's ballet Swan Lake. I know I mispronounced that, but I'm going to keep. This is a loose remake of Dracula's Daughter. The director's called this Ready or Not on steroids. This is the first collaboration for Bara outside of the Scream movies. Some people are comparing this to Megan. I kind of understand what they're doing there, but I don't necessarily kind of think that's great here. I kind of wondered this Dracula Daughter thing. I wonder if they were going to actually go there, and they're alluding to it, but they don't actually fully go into that. Abigail is a Hebrew name for Father's Joy. While likely a head nod or a coincidence, this film alludes to the monster ballerina from Cabin in the Woods as well. So that's what I'm going to leave. There's a lot of trivia on there. That's all I'm going to give because I thought those are the ones that were most interesting as I was kind of scrolling through it. But in conclusion, I thought this was a solid movie that I enjoyed my time with. This isn't doing anything new necessarily. There is good elements while using something that is tender like ballet dancing and having vicious attacks works for me. We have a solid cast here. This is well made. I thought that the setting, cinematography, framing, and the music were good. If I have nitpicks, it's with the computer effects. Doesn't ruin this by any stretch, but I would say give this one a watch as I had fun with my time here. So my rating here for Abigail is going to be a 7 out of 10. Now, I realize in my trivia that I was sharing, I might have went into a little bit of spoilers there. Sorry if you didn't know what the creature was and then I ruined that, but I'm not going to do any other spoilers outside of that. So let me go ahead and get you over to one last break before I close out the show. And welcome back one last time here. And just to kind of go through my social medias and stuff, if you'd like to send me an email, you can send that at journeywithacinephile@gmail.com. You can send me any sort of feedback, or if you have any questions or anything, go ahead and shoot them there, and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Or if you want to send me any screener links or anything like that, anything podcast-related, you can send it via that way. If you'd like to read any of the written reviews, I'll direct you to Reviews of the Dead, and that's horrorreview.webnode.com. If you'd like to become friends with me on Facebook, I'm David Michigan Garrett Jr. On Twitter, I'm Buckeye from Mish. Letterboxd, I'm David OSU. On Instagram, I'm DavidOSU87. On Threads, I'm DavidOSU87. And then Journey with a Cinephile has its own Instagram at Journey with a Cinephile, all one word. Now, all of these ones I will be sharing, like my ratings on whatnot. I know for Letterboxd, all of the reviews are going to be for horror and non-horror alike. Instagram I will be sharing over there is my different like posters and everything for things that I'm reviewing. My personal account, you might see some personal pictures every now and then if I can remember to take them. And then, you know, kind of same thing for Threads. And then Journey with a Cinephile is going to be more of just kind of posting podcast-related different stuff over there. And I'll also direct you to the Nightclub Discord channel, as I have a little section over there where we have some good conversations. I post all of my reviews and any new podcast episodes or some of the things I'm watching when I actually have time to post that. So keep an eye out over there, and I'll have the link for that and everything else in the show notes there. And then I'm also going to direct you, if a way that you can actually listen to the show is going to be through the PodNation TV. This is a streaming service and everything like that. There will be a link in the blog posts for all of my episodes, so if you'd like to listen to it that way. It's kind of a cool little thing. You can definitely do that through like Roku TV, and there's some other apps for it as well, just as another way for you to consume this podcast if you decide to. And there's also a lot of other great shows that are on that network as well. And for my next episode, it's going to be another of my foray through the force here, as the 1934 film is going to be Double Door. Not really sure a whole lot about this one, but I'm going to be pairing this up with Humane. I believe this is the one that is the Cronenberg daughter has this film coming out. I'm going to be going to the Gateway Film Center at some point this weekend to check that movie out. So those will be the two features, and I'll figure out what my through line will be as I've seen both of them. And then my Foray Through the Force rewatch is going to be Frankenstein and The Monster from Hell. Been a long time since I've seen this version. Not really necessarily sure what this one entails, since I watched them all so close together originally. And then I'll have more mini reviews for you. I do know that the Summer Challenge Series prep is coming up here soon. Not sure when that'll start officially. Well, I mean, when I will be start watching stuff. But if that's not the case, I will have, you know, some mini reviews for you. So I don't think there's anything else I need to go into here. So I will say in closing is thank you so much for listening. And whatever you do today, hope you're safe and have a great time out there. This is your tour guide of David Garrett Jr. And I am signing off.
It had been a wonderful evening. And what I needed now to give it the perfect ending.